everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 2 of the FDH Lounge. Happy to be here once again, hosted by Sportsology, and hosting along with me here tonight my good friend Russ Cohen, who navigated us through some issues. Apologies to anybody that tried to catch us at our previous scheduled time, but we're back and we're going strong right now. Russ, how you doing tonight, my friend?
Good, good. It's, you know, it's a different world right now. Everything's working, so we're happy, and that's a good thing.
Oh, that is. That really is. And we have a guest who's going to be on with us here tonight, and it's going to be a little something different. It's one of the things that we do in the FDH Lounge from time to time, and I think it's really one of those things that kind of gives us our extra gear and in some ways sets us apart, because we
love
to do...
You can set him up. He's waiting. He's
actually wonderful. I can go into my... my introduction for him. I know he's liked my introductions previously. I hope I can do him justice here tonight. Again, you may have heard him on our show a couple of times previously. The last time he was on, it was a real matter of coincidence when you look at the overlap of some of the FDH Lounge guests. He was on the same night as Jim Peterick, founding member of Survivor and also Ides of March, and it so happens that I guess Jim had worked with his daughter Kara on a project. Kara, of course, being a big cheese in the music industry as an executive and songwriter, as well as a TV personality on Bravo and past judge on American Idol. But so real coincidence there with Joe, and we just recently had on the show one of his good friends, Pat Cooper, who has had some kind words for him, vaunted comedian that he is. But we have with us here tonight a gentleman who it's a pleasure to have on the program. I've said to him previously on the show, I'm somebody where I happen to agree with where he's coming from on a lot of his public policy positions, and I enjoy listening to him talk about it and break down our issues. But again, as a recovering idealist, there's not a lot of there's very few professional politicians that I really hold in any regard whatsoever. And I've said to him on the show previously, I appreciate about you, you are not a professional politician. You know, you're somebody who, you've been in Congress, you ran a couple of times in a tough district, you've always told it like it is, and you've never trimmed your sails to get reelected. You've always told the tough truths. And he's an expert on public debt. And that's one of the things we certainly want to talk to him about tonight here, with everything that just went on with the default ceiling, or the debt ceiling getting raised recently with the specter of default. This is somebody who was the first elected member of Congress who was a practicing CPA at the time. He has a lot of experience in this area. He participated on the federal bailout of New York City back in the 1970s, the restructuring of their debt, and the SNL bailout of the late 1980s. So who better to talk to about the mountains and mountains of red ink facing our country right now than a good friend of the show, Joe DiAguardi. Joe, good to have you on tonight, sir. How are you, my friend?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I was sitting here listening, and I said, is that me? Today I'm known as Kara's dad, not as former Congressman Joe DiAguardi.
Hey,
and by the way, you know that people just are finding out about it, but believe it or not, about a month ago, or maybe almost 2 months ago, she was called by the producers of Chicago very quietly to come in and to discuss whether or not she wanted to take Christie Brinkley's role in Chicago. And she then, you know, spent 2 weeks doing some practicing. Don't forget, this is a Bob Fosse kind of choreography. You got to be an acrobat to do it. And sure enough, they just shook her hand when she came in singing and dancing, and she opens up on Broadway September the 5th. Would you believe it?
Wow.
In the lead role in Chicago, Roxy. In fact, she just flew in and is going to be practicing with the cast for the next 3 weeks. So how do you like that? Now
it's
a real challenge. Can she put together singing, dancing, acting? We already know she's a songwriter. So, hey, I pushed her. I was kind of like her Jewish-Italian mother when she was a kid, pushing her into bigger and bigger crowds. She was 7 years old, and you should have heard her voice. And I made sure she sang at community events. When she was 12, I was the chairman of the dinner for Sophia Loren, who was the Grand Marshal of the Columbus Day Parade and Dinner. And Kara sang at the Waldorf 4 songs at the age of 12 and brought the house down. So you could see she had something in her way back then.
Wow.
Well, I'll maybe I should write a memoir about her. She just wrote her book.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent book, and I will say, she's very talented, as I said, a big deal in the music industry, but hey, for public policy nerds like myself, she'll always be Joe's daughter. you're the man, Joe, you're out there, you're breaking it down for people. I really respect that. I know a lot of our listeners do, too. The great thing is, too, I think people, they whether or not they agree with all of your prescriptions, nobody can take issue with your diagnosis of the situation, where we're at, and that there's going to be some strong medicine that's needed. And where we're at right now, again, as I say, you know, the debt ceiling was just raised recently. The last time we'd had you on the show was last December, so it was before any of this stuff had happened. They were negotiating at the time in Congress what would be the extension of the Bush tax cuts that did go through. So we're looking at a situation now where there is a 12-member super committee from Congress that's going to be set up to negotiate the cuts that are going to be coming here at this point. But
well, nothing's going to happen. I'm telling you right now, let me forecast it as I forecasted 20-something years ago when I wrote the book. It's almost 20 years, Unaccountable Congress. It doesn't add up, and I just updated it, as you know, at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the first one to say that this credit card mentality, I put a credit card on the front cover of the book. Guess what it was? A congressman's voting card, or a congresswoman's. I said, credit line unlimited, expiration date never, bill to future generations. And in chapter 4 of that book, I took my experience from the bailout of New York City. Don't forget, my firm at that point was the largest accounting firm in the world, Arthur Andersen, and we were hired by the Treasury Department to figure out how we might be able to structure a bailout for New York, and I had the honor and pleasure to work with people at Lazard Frères and several other partners. I was the young partner at the time, and I got my baptism by fire on how these large governmental agencies lie about their financial condition. In those days, New York City had on the books buildings that had been burned, and they were still anticipating the revenue in their budget. So you can imagine that this was something that affected me, and I brought to Congress with me in 1985 when I began to serve. But, you know, if you think New York City was bad, you have to see and you have to read the book, Unaccountable Congress, to understand how bad the federal government is when it comes to systemic things like financial reporting, like budgeting using the right accounting system, and so many other things. But I remember in Chapter 4, which I titled The Big Apple and Washington, One Bailout After the Other, I said at the end of that, I said, if Washington keeps spending money we don't have and borrowing from countries we don't trust, in those days it was Japan, now it's China, and still some Japan, I think, then who's going to bail us out? And that's the debate today. Now, why do you think Standard & Poor's did what they did? Well, they made a case that what they saw was so dysfunctional, the political way that both parties tried to deal with it, and what they saw was so inferior, the way they put forth less than $1 trillion now, and then we have the super committee, and we're going to get another $1.5 trillion, when everybody was expecting at least $4 trillion of spending cuts for the next 10 years to really bend down this debt curve. Don't forget, when I was a congressman, the national debt was less than $1 trillion. Now, the bonded debt, now remind you, I mean, you know, you almost have to slow down because there's so many ways they trick people into thinking about things being better than they are. The bonded debt is $14.3 trillion, and now we're over it, and by the end of this fiscal year, which is going to be September 30th, 2011, it will be over $15 trillion. But that's the good news. The bad news is that we have more debts that are not bonded, but they're not recorded properly. And if you read the new edition of my book, you will see that the national debt today, if you looked at what accountants under generally accepted accounting principles, which are mandated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, subject to stiff penalties, including jail, it's called securities fraud. And what's the biggest issue of securities in the world? The United States government. Treasury, bills, bonds. You know, the debt is over $60 trillion. Now, you might say, well, Joe, how could it be that you're saying the debt's $60 trillion and we keep hearing, you know, 14.3? Well, number one, they're not telling you where to find the numbers. And one of the articles that I wrote that appeared in Roll Call magazine or newspaper in Washington 2 weeks ago, the day before they announced that they had this Mickey Mouse solution for the debt ceiling, that article said that the numbers, like Osama bin Laden, are hiding in plain sight. You have to know where to find them. And I directed the readers to the Treasury Department's site, website, into publications, and to last year's edition of a statement called The Consolidated Financial Statements of the United States of America. And if you go into the footnotes, not on the balance sheet, you will find the numbers that I pointed out in that article, and I've got that article in front of me, and let me just tell you what they are.
Here's Wait, Joe, before you do that...
At the end of last year, it was $13,637,000,000. That's publicly held, and also the money in the Social Security Trust Fund. Don't forget, there's no money there. They put IOUs. They're called Treasury bills. Medicare, plots A, B, and D, $22,813,000,000. Social Security, $7,947,000,000. Federal employee pensions, that's military pensions, civil service, VA benefits, $5.7 trillion and other. And when you add in the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the guarantees that we have to cover because they borrow on their deficits with the full faith and credit of the United States of America, you're over $60 trillion. They're lying to you. These are outright lies. I'm trying to wake up the accounting profession to become an army to educate the public that there is a system of accounting that is now lulling us into thinking we're better than we are. I'm going to conclude
my thing. And Joe, I know you said something there that caught the attention of Russ. So, Russ, take it away, buddy.
Go ahead.
Well, just before you go further into it, Joe, I just want to ask you, and this, I may be wrong about this, but was the last time that the budget was balanced back in the Clinton era? Was it that long ago?
There was no balanced budget in the Clinton era. That,
Social Security, right, Joe? They raised Social Security to do it.
Clinton claimed he had 4 years of surpluses. That was a lie. The only reason he had surpluses in those 4 years was why the deficits were lower than they were for the other 36 years since Lyndon Baines Johnson is that they took the surpluses annually from the Social Security Trust Fund and they netted it against the deficit. So if you didn't do that, and that's called a unified budget, Lyndon Baines Johnson came up with that trick in 1968 to disguise the cost of a very unpopular war called Vietnam. That's why he didn't run. So if you take back those annual surpluses in those years, and then we had Medicare, then Social Security and Medicare, you had no surpluses. This is the shell game that's being played today, and unfortunately it's being played with the next generation because we are stealing from one generation and giving to another. But that question is a very good question you raised. So there's been no balanced budgets ever since the Eisenhower days. So, you know, who are we kidding? And what accounting system are you using to balance the budget? The ones that politicians create or the ones that the accounting profession creates that's been adopted by law, by the way, passed by Congress, but they exempted themselves from the Securities and Exchange Commission laws of 1933.
So, Joe, and this kind of leads into another thing here, and that being one of the reasons for that, and this is one of the things that I know you're going to be able to speak on and that you know very well. We've heard a lot recently, this nomenclature about cuts that are coming. We're going to cut, you know, $4 billion over 10 years or a trillion over 10 years. These aren't cuts as most people would understand them. These are cuts in the projected rates of increases of spending. You have in many budgets, and that's one of the reasons that the budget doubled over the last 10 years or so, and that George W. Bush, who was a pretty big spender in his own right, but you had a lot of these things happening here. If you've got annual rates of increases for a lot of these agencies of 3 to 8% every year, the way that they score these things is, let's say the Defense Department was supposed to go up 6% and it only goes up 2% in a year, that is scored as a 4% cut. And
right.
The entire language of this thing is corrupted, Joe.
Look at the Congressional Budget Office. They have a baseline. And then they say, well, to provide the same services next year, since we're going to have an increase in the population of a certain percent, then we've got to increase that amount so that you never have really an actual cut. You're right. And that's a problem. In fact, if you look at the whole budget process, what do they do when they do a budget? Do they ever go down to what they call zero-based budgeting? In other words, justify for us every year or every 2 years from the bottom what you think it's going to cost to run your agency? No. They said, well, we spent that last year. Give us another 5%. Well, what happens if we wasted money last year? Which we know we did. And I hope Peter Grace found this out. We're just building on the waste year after year after year because they refuse to go back and do what you call zero-based budgeting, forcing the bureaucrats to justify all the spending from the first dollar up. Isn't that a logical thing to be doing at some point? They don't do it. So we got these issues, and for 40 years, and you want to know why we are in this place we are now. Let me just say it. We've been running negative cash flows for 40 years. We've been borrowing from Americans and foreign governments for 40 years. We've been borrowing from the trust funds, Medicare and Social Security, for 40 years. And we've had 4 years of stealing from one generation and giving to another. We've got federal pensions and civil service pensions included, military, what you call pay-as-you-go. They are not funded at all. There's not even a treasury bill that you can, you know, take out and sell someplace. So we got to, you know, what's the answer? The answer is to define, number one, let's go back to square one before we get to the numbers, okay? Let's define government. What should the federal government be doing and what should the states be doing? We haven't decided that yet. Why are the states not given the respect that they deserve as sovereign entities? The Constitution says that. Now, there are things that the state can, you know, this federal government can usurp from the states. And one would be, obviously, national security, the military operations, probably things like nuclear energy and even the environment. But let's get to things that they should not be in. Education. Why shouldn't those be devolved back to the states? And what's the reason for it, Rick? The reason for it is government operates best when it operates closest to the people. The more you move operations of government away from Main Street and the communities, the less accountability there will be, and that's what we have today. So we have not properly defined government. That's what Congressman Ryan was trying to do with the budget he proposed for 2012. I mean, the debate on what the federal government should be has only just begun, and it has to continue. Why? The people are fed up. We cannot afford this kind of money, and worse than that, God forbid interest rates start going back to where they were only 10, 15 years ago, you know, 8, 9, 10%. And don't forget, under Jimmy Carter, stagflation, what was that? Stagnant economy, which we have, and inflation, which is coming. The prime rate was 21%. I remember having a mortgage on a piece of property in Reading, Connecticut, where I was paying 15%. That sounds like Alice in Wonderland right now. Mark my words, within 10 years, you're going to see interest rates somewhere between 8 and 12%. Why? The federal government has flooded the world with dollars. I mean, you don't have to listen to Ron Paul to understand that he's right. We have now created the penchant or the inclination for inflation that's incredible, but it had to be done in order to keep us out of a recession. Why don't you think Bernanke is talking about QE3, quantitative easing 3? Because he's run out of bullets. You can't do it because he knows inflation is rearing its ugly head. The price of cotton has doubled. Gas, even if you remove the cost of gas and food, you're talking about commodities going up. So he sees the ugly signs already. So we don't want to go from one crisis, which is what we had from 2008, into another one, which is high inflation, which then robs everybody who's got pensions and everything else. So we're in a catch-22, and Congress is doing nothing. There is no leadership, not in either party, not in the White House, and I just hope that we see a different story in the next few months. But how can this super committee do anything? They put four people on this committee that were on the Simpson-Bowles Commission, the four that voted against using the principles of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, or voted against the actual policies of the commission. That should have been made mandatory. If Obama was really serious about doing something, I mean, he seemed to be so serious about health care, why wasn't he serious about straightening out the economy? He would have made that mandatory, that commission, with two good guys, Bowles and Simpson, just like we had the base closing commission when I was a congressman. Take it out of politics. He didn't do it. And we're stuck with a big mess right now.
All right, we really are. You hit a couple of hot buttons there, Joe. I want to get to that. I just want to put it out there, too. We got, as I understand it, if my stopwatch is correct, about another 10 minutes worth of live time here, and I guess there'll be about another 10 minutes just for the after one here, so it gives us a sat on the pacing. But I like a couple of the things that you pointed out there when you talked about power going to the states. I'm a big 10th Amendment guy myself, and with Governor Perry in the race now, at the very least, the 10th Amendment is getting talked about in that sense, no question about it. But as far as where things are at and the Simpson-Bowles Commission and some of the different precepts of that, there were some of those that were getting bandied about in the talks between Obama and Boehner. And I wrote a column for our blog, and, you know, I probably got some heat from some people about this because I said, look, I'm a big Tea Party guy. I hate taxes with every fiber of my being, but I also believe in the Laffer curve. I believe that, you know, there is a point in time, you know, with some of these taxes where they will raise revenue before damaging the economy. Not every tax is sapping to the economy at every level. And my sense has been, if you have to put revenues on the table to get deep cuts, you look for ones that won't really do any harm, but I think there has to be an openness to that. And I know that that's poisonous among a lot of Republicans to say this. I want to get your sense of this because you're a guy who's, you know, fixated on the debt above all else. And I know that you understand, as I do, that economic growth needs to happen as well. But what's your sense about this, of putting some tax increases in there or revenue increases or whatever it's going to be, however it's called, versus all the cuts that have to happen also, actual cuts?
Wait, well, this is Rick that was speaking, right?
Yes.
Rick. The tax code is a mess. Now, you probably didn't drill down deep enough in my bio to realize that I was a tax partner at Arthur Andersen. I started in auditing, but when I was made a partner, I was an expert in taxation. You know what you need to have a tax code or a tax activity that operates properly? One, you need it to be simple so people understand it. Two, you need it to be fair, so people will figure out, hey, you know, I want to pay my taxes because I'm getting a fair allocation. Three, you need to raise enough money with that tax code in order to equal the expenses for that year, and then you don't have to borrow. So you have three major things we looked at when I was a CPA, when we looked at states and municipalities mainly. These were the things we looked for to see whether or not there was a fair, adequate, effective tax system. We don't have it. The Internal Revenue Code is a mess. It's either got to be completely revamped so that you take away all the deductions except those that are absolutely important for societal reasons, namely maybe charitable deductions, and two, maybe the fact that we continue interest deductions to a certain amount on housing because housing is important. So I'm one that wants to see that code completely restructured, but I'm also open to a whole new kind of taxation, whether you call it a fair tax, a flat tax, or even a VAT tax. And they have good qualities. Some could have a bad quality, but you got to look at what is better than we have right now. But what you got to do, and you got to make sure, is that you don't start one without killing the other. Because if you have two major ways to collect taxes, the rates will go up on both. The politicians will love it. So you got to be very careful. So my feeling is, yes, you do need revenues, but you need to collect the revenues we're not collecting. We got a very complicated self-assessment system. It's not like property taxes, Rick, where you get the bill every 6 months. We're in a self-assessment system. We trust people to prepare their own tax returns, send them in with the checks. In many cases, it's deducted if you're an employee, but if you're a business person, you got to pay some of it in advance, and you pay the rest when you pay your taxes. And then maybe, you'd be subject to an audit. But there's so few IRS agents relative to what happened in prior years, the chances of that happening are not good. Now, what does that mean? That means that we're not collecting. There are people, we have a cash economy that's hundreds of billions of dollars. There's much money in America that's being earned that's not being taxed at one end. At the other end, you've got the Internal Revenue Code, which has created monstrous loopholes. for foreign corporations to keep huge amounts of cash offshore. Read the papers about Apple. I think they said they have $70 or $80 million in a trillion. Is it no 80? What's the number? It wasn't a trillion, but a billion, I think. Maybe 100 million. Yeah, I got to get. You know, you go from trillions to billions to millions. It's just amazing how you can mess that up. But the point is, it's a huge amount of cash that these corporations are sitting on. Much of it is offshore, and they're not going to bring it back here because they say, yeah, we might be able to create jobs, but we'd like to not pay taxes on it to create jobs. Well, maybe we should do something about that. The point is, we need to get rid of these loopholes, and I think you'll then see revenue go up. Yes, there has to be some kind of revenue, but it doesn't mean you have to increase the taxes on people to do it. You've got to restructure the code and restructure the way we collect taxes so that we collect more taxes from people that are not paying taxes.
Joe, this is Russ. My question to you then would be, or just answer, maybe you could just give us a good answer or a good response to what Warren Buffett was talking about the other day, where he's basically admitting he only pays 17% tax. The average person's paying over 30, which is still good compared to England, though, right, where they do 50. But he's only paying 17, and that meant like $7 or $8 million, where he's willing to pay a lot more, but because the system doesn't work that way,
right,
he doesn't have to, and there's a lot of millionaires and billionaires
right
that are paying a lower percentage than the people, than the hard working class.
Yeah, why is that? Right. It's not fair, and people get cynical when they hear that, and I'm happy he did write that editorial. I read it in the New York Times, and I think he's making a very good case. Why am I being let off the hook? I think that is a good case, and I think, frankly, you've got to find a middle ground. If you're talking about, you know, taxing the rich, maybe the line isn't $250,000, because that's where you have a lot of small business people that are filing on what they call subchapter S or partnership type returns, where they pay it individually. But certainly, if you're making over $1 million, and I think, you know, Buffett said that in the article, why not tax them? And if some people are making $10 to $20 million, maybe there should be even a higher percentage. I'm open to something that's fair. Okay? I'm not that kind of ideologue that says, come on, you know, if you want to reduce spending by $4 trillion or more, we got to have at least some percentage of that in revenue. And some people say it should be like 25%. I think we've got to get reasonable people to focus on these things and get the ideologues out of the room. Why? Because our party today is not Republican or Democrat or conservative or independent or libertarian. Our party today is America. We're all on that same ship. When the Titanic went down, even those people in the penthouse deck got wet. You remember? I think you saw the paper, the picture, Titanic. You remember when the watchman saw the boat, the iceberg, almost too late? It was too late. Well, he thought he missed it. They had to turn that huge ship around by putting the engines in reverse, and they were sweating, and then they saw the ship pass it. What they didn't know, they hit the iceberg on the bottom. We're going to do the same thing, because our spending and the way we are in debt, most of what the public sees is the bonded debt. They don't see the $60 trillion plus or the $60 trillion minus the bonded debt. That's the iceberg. We're going to hit it on the bottom, not on the top. We're not going to hit what we see. We're going to hit what we don't see, and we're not prepared for it. We have not prepared for what's coming, because in good years, we put nothing aside. We even took the money out of the Social Security Trust Fund, which was earmarked with separate FICA taxes. Okay? So we've done everything wrong, and now we've run out of options, and the politicians now are just gaming each other. They're just saying, we don't want to get unelected, and we don't care anymore about the future. Just, we want to keep our job. And that's the way they're acting.
By the way, that answer right there, if anybody was wondering, if anybody looked at the bio and wondered about this with you, Joe, why you, as a two-term congressman who had served previously in the House, why you weren't the choice of party bosses last year, why you had to get past the choices of the party bosses, that right there is it. It's an independent answer. You're a guy who can't be controlled, and that's the thing.
Absolutely.
I respect about you.
I had the conservative line. You know, in New York State, we have these minor parties. I had the conservative line. I had the tax expand line. Now, why would anybody in the Republican Party think that they could win if they don't have the conservative line? I mean, you know how many Democrats are registered in the state versus Republican. You can't win without having it. I had it already. They made me look like I was marginalized at the May convention. And when I didn't get the 25% because you had the Motto faction on one side pushing Mr. Blakeman, but they really, the Motto really wanted to get his partner's daughter in there. That's Gillibrand.
Mm-hmm.
But the Motto is a partner with Mr. Rudnick in Park Agents, or Park, I forget the name of it, it's Park something. And he really wanted Gillibrand there. That's why when Cuomo, you know, when Basil Patterson, who was the guy that was, yeah, Spitzer, it was Patterson, who was there? When Gillibrand was appointed, it was the Motto. So we knew he wanted her because right now his action is to make money. He's a lobbyist, okay? Then we've had all these guys that were working for Pataki. They needed jobs. So what do? They go behind this guy, Malpass, who was the chief economist for Bear Stearns that went under, and he now thinks he can become a senator, and they're pumping him up that he can be a great senator when obviously he wasn't competing against me because during the summer I had, you know, way, my polls were way ahead. But I was afraid of him because he had money. The point is, I had a win in a three-way primary on September the 14th, which I did, and then have to prepare for a major election. This is what the Republican Party does to you in this state if you're not a puppet. If you're a puppet and you can be bought, hey, they want you in there. But if you're someone who wants to do the right thing for the people, they'll do everything to keep you out, even losing the party designation. And that's, this is a crime.
Very, very well said. We're into the extra time here for the archive only. We have time for one more answer, maybe two, depending on how it goes. I want to ask you about this, Joe, about the concept of sacred cows. We had on the show a couple of months ago former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, and in addition to gleefully asking him some questions about his pro wrestling career, that was fun. We also got talking public policy. He was somebody who professed to identify very much with your good friend Ron Paul, and I thought I sniffed something there that wasn't quite right, and I started asking him questions about this because all he was talking about, I like Ron Paul because of his non-interventionism. I like Ron Paul because he's going after corporate welfare. I said, what about restructuring entitlement programs? What about the things that are going to hit the middle class and the sacrifices that everybody's going to have to make because we're spending money we won't have to? And his answer was that essentially that if we do these other things, we won't have to do this. So he basically, whether he realized it or not, more or less admitted that he liked like half of the Ron Paul message and didn't want to talk about the other half. So what do you have to say about that, about people who, again, I think maybe latch on to certain parts of a message of, okay, I understand this is what we have to do, we need some austerity and everything, but a lot of times people are reluctant to let go of their own sacred cows and understand that really everybody's going to have to give to get us out of this situation.
You said it. If there isn't shared sacrifice now, nothing is going to happen except America going down, the value of the dollar going down, China yelling about their yuan becoming now the reserve currency instead of the dollar, and we're going to then find ourselves in a situation in 10 to 15 years where China is going to emerge as probably, and I hate to say it, but the number one economic power because they're planning for the future. We're not. So there has to be shared sacrifice. We have a burden on these entitlements, which has to be somehow, if not restructured, somehow looked at to be made fair. We don't want to see Social Security go bankrupt or Medicare plots A, B, and D go bankrupt. But the way they're heading right now, if we don't restructure these entitlements, they will go bankrupt. One is destined to go bankrupt in, I think it's 2017 or 2020, that's the Medicare, because of Medicare Part D in particular, and they said Social Security would go bankrupt by 2037. Does that mean they're not going to get benefits until that? No. But what's happened this year, everybody now is hearing that this is the first year out of 40 where the Social Security Trust Fund is taking in less money than it's putting out. And you mentioned before that the deficits have gone way up too fast. Why? Well, number one, we've put the wars on the books that Bush started, right?
Yep.
And number two, you have this issue now that you don't have surpluses in Social Security annual collections to offset like Lyndon Baines Johnson did, and we did for so many years after that. So we're now paying for the sins of the past, not only with the lousy accounting that's now causing the deficits to be much higher than they would have been, but we're now looking at these entitlements and we're saying, how can we afford to keep our obligations for the people in the future? So I think you have to look at everything. I really do. And we got to be fair about this. And when the ideologues come in the room, they're not looking to be fair. They're looking to avoid primaries. Don't forget, the Tea Party people that got elected, they got elected for a good reason. People are upset. And they had to promise things that many of them right now would say to themselves, well, maybe I, you know, to get elected, I promised too much, but you know what? I got to keep my promises. So what do others then tell them? If you don't keep your promise, we won't have you primaried, and you'll lose your election even before you get into the general election. So now we've got shotguns to everybody's head, you know, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to save America. We got a lot of thinking to do, and I feel like Thomas Paine. You know, we had a good Tea Party guy, his name was Thomas Paine, and read Common Sense when he defined government and he defined society. He said, society is a patron. Society is a product of man's and woman's affection for each other. Government is a punisher. Government is there to protect us from our vices. And what adds insult to everything is when we provide the means for government to punish us. And guess what he said that was? Taxation. So this debate was going on in 1774 and 5 before the Declaration of Independence. It's nothing new. We've got to now deal with it. But we've got to deal with it like adults, like professionals, like that, not like politicians who just want to get elected. And by the way, you want to really solve the problem? You got to go to the electoral process. There should be one term for president, 6 years. This bullshit about, you know, getting in and then raising $1 billion because you need to have your second term, and now for next year nothing's going to be done, and then there should be 3-4-year terms for the House. 2 years for the House is ridiculous. Money is now controlling the system, and these consultants are. So you need 3-4-year terms for the House, 2 6-year terms for the Senate, and 1 6-year term for the President, and you'll see how fast the government starts operating the way it was intended by the founding fathers.
Excellent, Joe. You know, like the seasoned public speaker you are, you used our remaining time to bring it around and give us the ultimate prescriptions there. It is always a pleasure having you on the show and talking with you, Joe. We've got a link up on our blog here tonight to your truthandgovernment.org organization.
Let them look at that website because there's a lot there I'm sure they'd be interested in seeing that I haven't said.
Absolutely. It's all right there, and we appreciate it. Joe, it's always great to catch up with you. You know, even for a guy like me who's, like I said, a real nerd about this kind of stuff, I learn from you, and I know that the listeners do, too. Thank you so much for coming on. We look forward to doing it again.
Thank you, Rick.
I appreciate it,
Thanks,
Joe. Thanks very much, Joe.
Thank you.
So, just and again, to wrap up here tonight, we get to do so in a little more orderly fashion than last week. I didn't realize last week how it was going to go with the cutoff there, but we're mastering it a little bit better here tonight. So, again, I just want to thank Joe for having been on, and Russ, excellent, setting this up for us and participating with me on this. Really, a great pleasure to get to do this with you tonight, Russ.
Yeah, same here. And again, I'm not usually a big fan of political discussions. You know, I watch some Daily Show. I certainly vote, but not necessarily my realm. It was interesting to hear him talk. Certainly, I lived in New York during that time when he was talking about New York being broke, so I remember that being a big issue. You know, there's a lot to take in. There's a lot to digest, and I think if more people like Joe were on some of these shows rather than the paid liars, maybe people would learn a bit more. I mean, it definitely couldn't hurt.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I like anybody who likes ideas. And we've done some mixing it up on the show. Colin Delaney from ePolitics, he's a guy who agrees with me a lot less than Joe does, but it's fun mixing it up with him, too. But, yeah, anybody who's sincere about ideas, it's a good thing to do. It's a really, really, really brutal time in our history. We got a lot of big problems, so I enjoy getting to break it down, once in a while here and get to do this. I don't know exactly what we're going to have going for mini episode 3. It'll probably be on back on a lighter topic again when we do this next week or whenever's the next time we hook up. But
sure.
It was a lot of fun here tonight, Russ.
It was, and I can give you another pet peeve short topic that people should look into, and I sort of got the idea from a TV show. There was a show on Discovery or whatever. There was a show called The Inspector, and this guy would basically walk around and inspect the infrastructure of all these different cities, and he would see where bridges are rotting and roads are rotting and just terrible things going on and nothing being spent on that. And that's part of that equation where I say, hey, you know what? If you have to pay some taxes, which you do, there should be a good amount going to infrastructure. And I, at least in New Jersey, I can only speak for what I see in New Jersey, all the overpasses in my area and everything that dealt with the Jersey Turnpike all the way down seems to have all been renovated this summer. I hope those kinds of things are going on in a lot of other cities in the country, because I got to tell you, otherwise that's when disaster strikes, and then all of a sudden you're spending 10 times the amount instead of just, you know, what it would cost to upgrade.
Good call. Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, human life comes first, but in terms of dollars also, what it cost them in Minnesota a couple of years ago was way more than it would have cost to have addressed that preemptively when they had to address the bridge over the Mississippi River in the Twin Cities area. So that's a very good point. So, all right, well, it's been great getting to do this here tonight with you, Russ, and we'll look forward to doing it again possibly next week, but sometime very soon we will have this up at the fdhlounge.blogspot.com also. So for Russ Cohen, this is Rick Morris for the FDH Lounge. We'll catch you next time, mini episode 3, the FDH Lounge.